Hi, everybody. This is Ben Starr.
This is Kev O'Donohue.
And this is Nasima Diane Deemer.
And you are tuned in to The Positive Mind.
Good to be here.
Bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. Here's a concept. Impulse control. It's one of the characteristics that really distinguishes us, humans, from other animals. And impulse control lives in a part of our brain called the prefrontal cortex, which is a part of the frontal lobe, right? Right up at the front of our brain. And the frontal lobe is a critical part of our brain, really, especially when you talk about what it means to be human. I mean, the frontal lobe is, you know, it holds our ability to project future consequences. It holds our decision-making, our rationalization, as well as our judgment, our language skills, memory, motor function,
ability
and problem-solvings. Yeah, it's all happening in the frontal lobe. And today we thought we'd be talking about impulse control, impulses, impulse control disorders, and what that means and where it comes from, because I think it's something that so many of us have experienced or have seen in others and in loved ones.
Yeah. And lucky if you have a nice big prefrontal cortex. To all those big prefrontal cortexes out there, you're lucky people. But we do know people that have a hard time with impulse control. I know people that have a hard time with it.
Yeah.
Especially this time of year.
Yeah, especially when there's like lots of chocolate around and cookies and candies, it's hard to control and not eat too much.
So impulse control and impulse control disorder, it's pretty commonly, I think, assumed that impulsivity gets a negative stereotype,
yes.
Right? And we want to go beyond the sort of binary positive-negative today and explore it a little more fully, because being impulsive doesn't just happen with something that could be strictly destructive, right? Like drugs or alcohol. Although that's very possible. It's very possible to be an impulsive drinker or an impulsive drug abuser. Being impulsive can happen with everyday things that are not otherwise dangerous, like shopping.
Working out.
Right? Working out. That's a good example. Or driving. I mean, how many people do you know out there who are totally even-keeled, down-to-earth people? As soon as you put them behind the wheel of a car, look out, right?
Yeah.
They get into a rage. They get into this impulsive, you know, irrational decision-making that's completely inconsistent with their character.
And there was that video of the two women fighting over a parking spot.
Yeah.
Like, brutal fighting over a parking spot.
Now, right.
There's something that needs to happen there.
So somewhere along the line, right? They're going through the motions of a very mundane activity, finding a parking spot.
Mm-hmm.
But a flip gets thrown. A switch gets flipped.
Yeah.
And this impulsivity takes over. Where does that come from? What's the root of that?
Yeah, and we're seeing so much of it, too. I mean, we're seeing some people that have real trouble with impulse control. And the short answer is that it's an adaptation. To give into your impulses, for some people, is a normal thing. It's an adaptation. It's the way that they compensate for deprivation, something that was missing in their childhood. The brain, you know, there's a lot of research on the brain development and deprivation in childhood. And when you see somebody who has a problem with impulse control, it's not something that we judge them for. You know, I feel, when I see the rageful driver, I just pull away, you know, and feel bad for the person. When I see a compulsive cigarette smoker or, you know, an impulse drinker or an impulse addict or something, you know, I don't judge them. I look at them and say, bad childhood or difficult childhood. You know, I don't even want to give it
the
bad.
Here's the difficulty, though, right, is not everyone, Kevin, is going to be able to take your perspective and implement that. There are a lot of people out there that they see that impulsive driver and they're ready to engage. And that's when you get real dangerous situations. So you mentioned impulsivity as a result of something lacking in childhood.
Yeah.
So what would that be?
Well, like you started with the prefrontal cortex, what happens is that the brain of a three-year-old child has, on a normally developed three-year-old, a nurtured child, let's say, has neuronal connections throughout the whole brain. If we look at the brain as a pile of, you know, fresh spaghetti just out of the hot water. It's floppy spaghetti just at birth. It's this neuronal entity just waiting for stimulation and waiting for connection. And if you are being stimulated with language, if you're being stimulated with touch, if you're being stimulated with a range of emotions, this floppy spaghetti is going to sort of straighten out like a straight piece of spaghetti and start making connections. And so it's like a choo-choo train. It's like tracks on a train. All this pile of spaghetti becomes multiple tracks that respond to stimuli outside the environment. If you don't have that, after 3 years, your brain is going to be half the size of a normally developed brain. And so what you do is you sit there as a deprived three-year-old and you say, oh, I need, you know, milk, or I need something in the environment. And paying attention to the person who's in charge doesn't get me that. So I'm just going to jump at whatever's available.
I love your analogy of as the young brain as basically a bunch of spaghetti. We've talked on previous shows when we discussed brain chemistry about the myelination process, right? So when we're born, we start off with lots of neurons, right? Mm. And the pathways that get drawn between those is a process called myelination, which is, I think, you know, the spaghetti analogy is great. It's a kind of a bunch of jumbled up pathways that then become forged as we age, as we mature.
Right. And another, you know, crucial part of development is the development of the parasympathetic nervous system, which allows us to sort of take down the impulse, the fight or flight, you know. It's like, so, and that's not developed till you're 18 months old. So if you don't have good reciprocation from your caregiver in those first 18 months, your parasympathetic nervous system is kind of offline. And that's why you don't have these, like, ability to take a deep breath before responding to whatever stimulus there is. You just go right into fight or flight.
It's great that you bring up the fight or flight impulse, because really, when we look at impulsivity at its core, it's a survival instinct. And compared to human beings, most animals out there, for the most part, won't be able to draw the connection between delaying gratification for a larger reward later.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Right? So most animals, if you put a plate of food in front of them, they'll eat it and keep eating as long as there's food in front of them.
Yeah.
Because, you know, regardless of whether they're full or not, they're not thinking about that. They're not thinking about the physical effect it's going to have on them. They're thinking, it's here now. Mm-hmm. I need to preserve myself now because I don't know the next time I'll be able to see food. And we're going to talk about a little bit more about that, about delayed gratification a little bit later. Mm-hmm. But I want to get back to this idea of impulse control or lack of impulse control as a result of childhood experiences or something that may have been lacking in childhood.
Yeah, so there are many ways to look at it. And I'm sure we can all look at our childhood and say we were deprived of something, you know. So we can always focus on the deprivation. But for people with impulse problems, impulse control disorder, it's a particular form of neglect and deprivation. And so one kind of deprivation is to always be under stress. If you are consistently living in fear in your home, and the fear could be, is the refrigerator going to be full? Are we going to have enough food? You know, for a 3-year-old, a 5-year-old, a 7-year-old, 10-year-old, a 15-year-old, to worry, to take on this adult worry at an early age is going to overload the parasympathetic system. You're always going to be on alert.
Yeah.
And so you're going to need to short circuit that. So, you know, if you see food at your local grocer available for the picking, you know, it might lead to you taking some of that in order to not eat necessarily, but just to slake this fear of persistent deprivation. And so the deprivation and the fear can be both external, we don't have enough food, or it can be internal, I'm constantly worried about our survival. And so that's a big task for a young developing brain. And so children can often pick up so many deprivations in the environment. So because of that, they can often live in fear and not develop the kind of prefrontal cortex that enables them to plan. You did this research on the marshmallow effect.
Yeah, it's a pretty well-known experiment from Stanford University called the marshmallow experiment. And it's been cited many times. It's been reproduced. And, you know, in fairness, there are many people who dispute it as far as its effectiveness in predicting, you know, future successes. But there are more people who kind of believe in it than who have disputed it.
Well, it's definitely proven in the delayed gratification part, but present it.
So what they did, this was at Stanford University, is they took a few hundred children aged between 4 and 6 years old, over 600 kids, and they brought them into a room and they explained to the children, they sat them at a table and they put a marshmallow on a plate and they showed this to the child. And they said to the child, "You're free to have the marshmallow now. It's totally up to you. I'm going to leave the room. When I come back, if you still haven't eaten the marshmallow, I'll give you a second one. But if you've eaten it, that's the only one you're going to get." So this is a very sort of simplistic, you know, delaying instant gratification for a larger reward in the future. And they would come back 10 to 15 minutes later.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't leaving
mm-hmm.
these kids in the room, you know, yeah. for an hour at a time.
Right.
It was fairly quick. Again, when you're 4 years old, 15 minutes might feel like a few hours.
Right.
Yeah.
But they found that most of the kids actually did delay the gratification.
Hmm.
And when they followed up with these kids years later, they found that the kids who were able to delay gratification were better off and more successful in a wide array of mm-hmm. factors and indicators, including physical and mental health, including educational achievement, including, you know, social well-being.
Mm-hmm.
So they found that this ability to overcome an impulse, you know, impulsive thought or impulsive behavior at a very early age was a predictor of future well-being.
Right. And it seems like they also had a trust in the person doing
yeah.
the
yeah,
experiment.
Yeah, they did. They were able
to
trust
what would happen.
Exactly. So there's that level too.
And the chances are that they were probably exposed at home. That, you know, if you do wait, you know, it's going to have a positive outcome.
Yeah, and the parents followed through.
That's so important. Pretty much the case. So what I hear that as is the kids that are able to delay gratification have a surplus. They're not living on the edge of deprivation. They have a surplus in themselves that talks to them and says to them, "Oh, you know, you get two of these if you can wait. And, you know, I'm not starving right now, and I can wait. And, I, you know, it's going to benefit me to wait. And so it's not that uncomfortable." And so if you were raised in an environment where you have a surplus of touch or a surplus of cognitive engagement, if you have a surplus of emotional connection.
Or of just basic resources needed to live, right? Food.
But, yeah, and well, parents following through as well. Resourced parents who are able to do that.
Take the example of language development. You know, I used to be a teacher, and, you know, the kids that were very verbal, you could hear it. You could just hear, they would just streamline conversation. They would have multiple word answers to things. And, it just occurred to me, and this was before I was interested in psychology, that I thought, oh, they must have been stimulated as children. Their parents or whoever their caretakers were encouraged them to not just answer yes or no, but to answer long questions and to speak. And that the parents, the kids that had the biggest and the highest development of cognitive and verbal skill, were encouraged to say more than their caretakers. Now, how about that?
Right.
You know, you can imagine the surplus in children that are given the latitude to talk more than mommy and daddy. And the development of their language skills because of that.
Which raises a fascinating question that we're always asking here at The Positive Mind, and really I think a lot of people are asking, is the age-old nature versus nurture debate, right? Were these kids less impulsive because they were raised in a certain way? Or
exposed, yeah.
Right, mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. were they less impulsive because they had less impulsive parents and grandparents? It's hard to say. I mean, we know when we look at, say, the issue of something as like addiction, right? Addiction and a lack of impulse control are obviously closely tied together. But did the lack of impulse control lead to the addiction, or is it that the addiction erases the impulse control?
I'm sure that the impulse control system kicked in before the addiction happened.
Yes.
And multiple times.
Yes.
And this is why addiction, you know, is a disease. You know, it is like diabetes. It's something
We do know that there are biological and genetic markers that make someone more susceptible to addiction.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
And to lack of impulse control. There are biological markers. The people that are less able to control their impulses frequently have less prefrontal cortex activity. You know, so there mm-hmm. is a biological foundation to this. So, you know, it's a good thing to know in advance that the people you see who are raging and who are out of control with their impulses and other behaviors, that, you know, I'm not excusing that, but often it is rooted in early development.
You're listening to The Positive Mind on 99.5 FM. I'm Ben Starr here with Kevin O'Donohue, Nassima Dayan-Deemer. We're talking about impulse control and impulse control disorders. Here's an interesting study that I found. These were some scientists at the University of Cambridge in England who looked at 50 pairs of siblings. And in all 50 of these pairs, there was one pair, one of the two siblings was addicted to cocaine. And the other sibling had no addictions, was sober, mm-hmm. living clean.
Mm.
And they found that when they did brain scans of each of these siblings, they had completely different sensory mechanisms between that prefrontal cortex,
yeah.
right, and the emotional center of their brain,
right,
which made it much more difficult for the addicted siblings to stop the impulses
mm-hmm.
that were, you know, leading them right. towards these behaviors.
Sure.
So basically, the self-control, I mean, when you consider that these are siblings, these are almost as close as you can get genetically, it makes you wonder if that addiction may, in fact, have changed the chemistry of the brain in eroding the impulse control centers.
Well, you bring up an important point, and we're having a guest, Michael Aaron, in 2 weeks, who's a sex therapist and a sex addiction specialist, and he was engaged in a lot of studies with congenital twins and studied, you know, that even homosexuality, one of the twins could be a homosexual 20% of the time and 80% not. And so there is definitely something, and he'll track it for us, to a part of the brain that attributes that development to that. And so, you know, it's same thing with congenital twins who have a problem with impulse control. It's not necessarily always a deprivation in the environment. It could be a deprivation chemically or in the brain. But Nassima, you deal with people who have a deprivation often of touch or who are phobic of being touched. Why don't you tell some people what you do?
Yeah, It's kind of an interesting paradox that, you know, in society, I mean, touch is really important for a person individually, but it's not that, you know, necessarily accepted. It's hard to touch people in this society. And so those people who are more deprived as kids, you know, just over the fear of, you know, not knowing how to touch your child, or maybe they're very sensitive. And so like the parental touch isn't really received. And then there's a whole bunch of like disturbed attachment that goes on, and that people can become phobic around touch. And it's really hard because it can feel so invasive. Like they immediately think it's going to be an invasion. And a couple of different things can happen out of that. People will ask for like super hard invasive touch, even though they're phobic of touch, which can be a trap for a massage therapist or a touch person, because then you end up hurting your client, which usually isn't what we want to do. Or you have the client who comes and just is learning how to negotiate, how to ask for the right kind of touch. And that's a lot of work that I do with people. It's like let's see how it feels when I just touch you in a way that's kind of containing you, that's kind of at your boundary but not going in or coming out. And, you know, just sort of see how you respond to that. Or even just sitting on a chair and having them touch themselves and notice how that feels. That can be a good first step, to just notice their own touch and their own skin and even the touch of the air, or how it feels to listen to something is another quality of touch. Mm. So those are ways we sort of step into it slowly. But
yeah, it makes me think of what you just described. You ever go to give someone a hug and they kind of don't know how to give a hug?
Yeah.
It's the strangest thing. I mean, so there are certain people who they go to give you a hug and they have their like shoulders squared back and their arms are really stiff and they give you kind of a shallow, you know, the shallow hug. And it makes you wonder if they just never got a proper hug and they never learned how to give a hug.
Yeah. You know, and it's somehow uncomfortable, invasive. Yeah. Yeah. Don't know how to sort of hold their boundary.
Sure.
And be able to hug. Because very often it feels like, you know, suddenly you're just like in my skin and they don't like that. You know, it's like, so it's you know, and I encourage it, very often people who are afraid of touch won't come for a massage or to a massage therapist. So, you know, I encourage anybody who is afraid of touching
to
come and, you know, like seek out someone who's going to pay attention to what you're saying and what you need. Because we're trained as touch therapists to listen to the client's needs. And so many times people just lay there and take whatever, you know, is happening, and they don't have to. They can definitely ask. And it can be a wonderful healing experience to ask for something different.
We need to research the connection between impulse control and phobias, because, you know, if somebody is phobic of being touched, often, you know, you can sense that they're just not used to somebody approaching them, and, and, you know, you're crossing over a boundary in a safe way, and it's not safe for them. And you have to wonder, you know, where does this track to? And you know, do they have impulse control issues?
Well, I wonder if it moves into the OCD, especially the germ phobic people, because it'll turn into, well, if somebody touches me, something could happen to me, or I could spread something to them.
Yeah.
It becomes like I become untouchable. And it's a tragedy, because we thrive on touch. It's so important for the human system and the human being to be touched, to feel a part of society. And it happens a lot to people who are quote unquote untouchable on the street, or, you know, that kind of thing. And it can be,
you know,
really
I know for
sad.
Myself, when I do get the chance to go for a massage, if I get a soft massage, it feels like a waste of money. You know, I need to somebody make that contact to a deeper part of my body. And that is what release, I don't know what it does release chemically, but I sort of need that kind of almost being beaten up feeling. And I know you, as a therapist, you would say, well, this is not healthy. This is not really optimal for your system.
It really depends on, you know, the needs of your tissues. But sometimes if you're, what can happen, like people will ask you to keep going deeper, 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 and here I am on their bones, and they're not feeling me. So that's someone who's like gone completely numb to touch on some level. I think you're probably receiving a certain amount of gratification and release of endorphins and all that, and that feels really good. But to ask someone to intentionally like bruise or injure your tissues is a very interesting form of like, you know, it's like
self-mutilation.
Like self-mutilation, really, in a way, and asking somebody else to participate.
We're going to talk about that in the second part
kind
of the show.
Kind of sadistic thing.
Some strange thing gets released. I don't know, Ben, do you like a rough touch? Because, you know, I think for me it's because I wasn't touched a lot as a kid.
When it comes to massage, yeah. I mean, when I've had massage, I like a deep tissue massage. Okay. I do like that. Yeah.
Well, I mean, deep tissue is fine, but when you talk about rough, it's interesting because it might be that in your atmosphere, rough touch was the only touch you got. So that's the touch you're used to.
Yeah.
That's the touch you're used to being touched with. And it can be really interesting to explore the softer realms, because it will, again, sort of allow the potential for a different experience of yourself and touch.
I need to approach this in a whole different way, to sort of reverse the forms of affection. As a kid, I have 9 brothers, and, you know, punching each other was the way to show, hey, I love you, man.
Exactly.
You know? But you're right. And being touched in that way, I can remember that and remember those. The harder the touch was, not if it didn't hurt, the better I felt.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe because I was getting this message that, hey, we care, I care, in addition to the touch factor. So it's very interesting. We're going to talk more about this and different types of impulse issues when we come back after the break.
Absolutely. And we touched briefly on impulse control disorder.
Yeah.
And I just want to briefly talk about that. We hear a lot about OCD, right? Obsessive compulsive disorder. But impulse control disorder is a very real thing. It comes in many forms. And you think about all the various ways that people can be feel totally out of control. Mm-hmm. With their impulses, whether, you know, it's, as we mentioned, eating or driving or shopping, but then, you know, it gets into some more destructive areas like drinking drugs, maybe it's acting out sexually, gambling, kleptomania, stealing.
Right.
These are all forms of impulse control disorder when they're taken to an extreme. And there are really five steps that happen within the impulse control disorder. And understanding them, I think, having the awareness, of course, as any struggle or challenge is the first step to working towards it, working towards bettering it. It starts with the basic impulse, right? And that's step one. Step two, there's a tension that builds.
Yes.
Around feeling this impulse but not acting on it. The tension builds and builds until finally there is the acting out of the impulse, which creates a pleasure, right? Now we have serotonin firing.
Yep.
Now there is a satisfaction and a pleasure being experienced for finally releasing the impulse, which is followed by relief. And these are, you know, this is including if it's a destructive impulse like the alcoholic, right? Maybe the alcoholic takes their first drink of the day and they just go, you know, it's a relief. And that is followed by
guilt,
but not always.
Sometimes.
Yeah. And so these are the five stages that go into following an impulse to its conclusion.
And this can happen in a millisecond, can't it? You know, the attraction, the satisfaction, the remorse. It can happen that quickly. I know for myself, when I'm at a party or something, you know, one drink turns to another is often from an impulsive place, and can really be very quick. It's almost like no decisions being made. It's just happening.
Right.
You know?
It comes from a certain discomfort, too, that you want to get out of, you know, and like you don't trust that, oh, that discomfort will pass or that, you know, this is enough.
Yeah.
So.
And so deprivation gets back to this idea of deprivation and impulse control disorder.
And we're going to explore all of that after the break. We're coming up on 1:30 here in New York City. You are listening to The Positive Mind here on WBAI. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back shortly after this musical break. And I hope everyone out there is enjoying the show and staying dry on a soggy Wednesday in New York.
Let me go. comes out and the rain has gone away, I know I'm gonna see a better day. Right now I think I'm crying, because of you I'm crying.
Dramatics here on WBAI in the rain. You're listening to The Positive Mind. I'm Ben Starr. I'm here with Kevin O'Donohue and Nasima Diane Deemer. We're talking about impulses, impulse control, important stuff. We talked a little bit about the brain chemistry behind it and some childhood roots and causes of it. I want to get back to that, Kevin.
Well, we talked about being afraid as a child, and that's effect on, let's say, impulse control. But there are other things also. If you didn't attach to your caretakers for whatever reasons, like if they put you into daycare and you just weren't ready for it, if your mother struggled with postpartum depression where she couldn't even pick you up as a child, this can also lead to future impulse control. What the child will do is he'll say, well, I'm not getting my needs met here. And so the myelination and the straightened out spaghetti of the brain is not happening. And so the child will jump to some other form of satisfaction. And they'll satisfy this impulse of, the impulse is in the direction of health and growth. And so when nature won't provide what would normally help you grow, you compensate. The brain and nature will compensate, and impulsivity is part of that. Remember, always when you're dealing with impulsivity, you're attempting to get your system back in balance. So if you have a parent, a mother who doesn't pick you up in the crib, is not stimulating you that way, you'll compensate. You'll develop impulse control issues.
You know, I was excited to ask you more about that, Kevin, and I was so excited after the break that I impulsively forgot to mention, as we usually like to mention,
go right ahead,
that you can always drop us a line at positivemind@wbai.org. That's positivemind@wbai.org. And we love hearing from our listeners. Any questions, comments, suggestions, love letters or hate mail,
and also becoming a buddy of the Positive Mind.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So you can go on the website, WBAI.org, and become a buddy. What is it, $10 a month?
Yeah, it's a recurring $10 a month, monthly tax-deductible contribution. Helps us support the station, helps eliminate future fund drives and reduce the length of future fund drives. Mm-hmm. So, again, that's WBAI.org. Click on Ways to Donate and become a BAI buddy.
And we want to remind listeners at 4 o'clock today, the general manager of the station will be talking to tell you about the future of the Positive Mind and all the programming here on WBAI. So tune in for that. We can't wait to hear from Bertold. And we're looking forward to being part of this wonderful station going forward for as long as we can. So becoming a buddy tells the station that you are a fan of the Positive Mind, and we want to, from time to time bring you Armand DeMille and Armand's research and fresh new research of Ben and mine and Nasima's and everybody here at the Positive Mind Center. So go to WBAI.org and become a buddy.
I think you should follow your impulses and donate.
Thank you.
So,
there's a healthy impulse.
So sorry for the non sequitur, but I'm just fascinated by this because I know so many people in my life that do struggle with impulsivity, and I have too, with various things at times throughout my life. I mean, even just in my family, I see people who have, impulse problems with either food or alcohol or shopping. And I see it, among friends and even colleagues and people I know loosely throughout my life.
Right.
And I've seen how it affects people. And, I want to explore this further because I think it's something that's so universally relevant. to everyone out there, you know, whatever, from all walks of life and from all backgrounds, everyone can relate to, you know, feeling like they're being dragged by an impulse and wishing and looking for the strength to overcome that.
And keep in mind that this impulse that was developed or this need is from the sympathetic, from the amygdala. It's extremely strong and it's about making you safe. So that's what makes it so hard to change it, because it is such a strong sort of natural biological, like this is getting me towards a feeling of safety, which is where my system wants to be.
Survival.
It's like deep survival instinct and to be safe in your system. And that's what drives it. And that's why it's so hard to change it.
Yeah. And there comes a time when the fallout is just way too great. And you need to do something. You know that, you know, the coping mechanism of the impulse isn't working anymore. So the fallout is just becoming dangerous to your survival.
Right.
What used to be used for survival just is not cutting it anymore. So how do we reverse that? What do we do? I mean, I think, again, there's no judgment, right? Mm-hmm. If you have struggles with impulse control, there's no judgment. What it is we're trying to say that chances are, you know, you just were not exposed to enough of what you needed, whether it's motor touch, whether it's cognitive learning, language, whether it is emotional or whatever. So we take that out of it and we say, how do I reverse this? And of course, the beginning is awareness. Now you do this.
I work a lot with this. And I think what's so important for the person who comes to sit down to try to, you know, do this kind of work either with me or with Kevin is to have their cognitive, their prefrontal, their cognitive adult self in the room, because it's the adult self that can say, you're going to be okay. You're not dying.
Right.
We can establish that right here, right now, we're safe. And if I don't meet this impulse, I'm not going to die, because that's what the child thought, that it was going to die if it did not get this met. And so we have to bring online the adult self and make sure that's in the room that's going to say, look, we've been through hard times before. I am an adult. I know how to take care of this now. And I know I'm not going to die
I've already lived through this.
And it's, you know, it's very important. And so
what's there when the impulse is neutralized? It's not satisfied, like Ben says. We have this 5-step process, but it's neutralized because I'm in the safety of an adult who is going to touch me in a safe way and that I can control.
Yeah. And the word neutralized is an interesting word. It doesn't have to be necessarily neutralized, but well, I guess that's right. Get, like, sort of take down the impulse so that you can actually feel what it was you really need.
Yes, and see that.
That's the next step, is wait a minute, I need to actually be touched really softly, and to be able to even voice those needs, or, you know, I need to not be touched, you know, and that can also be another, you know, thing. So that's all part and parcel for, you know, doing this kind of work, is negotiating what your need. That then you get to actually get underneath the impulse and find out what are your needs.
Exactly.
And very often you don't express that.
So I think, you know, what the safety of, you know, the therapy or the massage table or whatever you're trying to challenge is that when you're safe, you get to see. A lot of people have this problem. They don't even know what the impulse is. They're not even sure where it comes from. You know, so they just lunge at the thing.
Right.
Whatever it is.
And then it can manifest itself in many different ways.
And so here's like an interesting thing, like opiate addiction. You know, you think opiate addiction is because you just want to, you know,
feel good.
That's the reason you're addicted. And the real truth is that you have a fear. You know, the opiate addiction is satisfying a fear. It's not the high. It's not the good feeling that you're getting, but it's a fear that's feeding this opiate addiction. You fear pain. And when you take the opiate, your brain has a chance to think different things, because they're finding that people who are addicted to opiate addiction have a narrower focus. Their brain, their mind cannot expand to include other material. And when they have the opiate, the mind is suddenly away from this vigilance of pain.
Right.
and has been, you know, is freed up to think different things.
Right.
And so if you've been, you know, under stress your whole life, and now you're grown up and you're finding a relief in this, finally in this substance, this is your chance to finally get to think. Of course you would become addicted. Of course you would have a hard time.
The opiate epidemic has just been unbelievable. I mean, it's exploded in the last 5-10 years across the whole country. But, you know, even right here, you know, in New York and the tri-state area, it's really a devastating thing. And it's definitely something we want to, and when we
treat opiate addicts, we help them, you know, we tell them right up front, so what's your issue with pain? I mean, what is your fear? Let's go to the fear. Let's not waste time. You know, your time is valuable. Our time is valuable. Can you see that you're afraid of pain?
And I also want to include just those people that, you know, the minute they get the blush of a headache, they'll reach for the Advil. You know, it's like maybe the headache is saying you need to drink some water, you need to take care of yourself, you need to lay down and take a nap.
You need to sleep more.
You need to sleep more. You need to de-stress. You need to, you know, release tension. So it's like it can be that subtle. Of like the minute I feel something, boom, right to the Advil, right to something, you know.
So we're going to take some calls pretty soon. I just wanted to run through, Ben, a couple of other ideas about deprivation that you know, we can all be exposed to, and some people are just more sensitive and their parasympathetic nervous system is in overdrive. But if you grew, you know, hyper arousal, you would think that, you know, that would be a positive thing, that the stimuli is constantly there going on around you.
But being overstimulated?
Yes. I mean,
a sensory overload?
Sensory overload. If you have a violent family, a fighting family, a loud family, an addicted family, if there's smoking going on in your upbringing, if there's a lot of arguments going on, this is a sort of arousal. Or the TV is always on, the radio is always on, the conversation is always overloaded.
What about if you grew up in a city like New York or a place like Manhattan, where, you know, the sensory overload is constant in terms of the noise, the sights, the smells?
Yeah, and people say about the alertness of New Yorkers, and you know, that alertness is to fend off, is to be able to manage all this arousal. So
how does the hyper arousal affect impulsivity?
Well, because you don't have a place of rest, your system is constantly on alert. If you're a child that's constantly exposed to stimuli, and it's not satisfying stimuli, it's just noise. It's just you can't make head or tails of it. Your system gets overloaded, and the only satisfaction you would get is to retreat and go into my room and put on my headphones, or go to the refrigerator and eat, or
get high.
Or get high, or take some Advil or some pain medication or anything to get away from all this arousal.
To sort of induce a parasympathetic rest and relaxation. Yeah, you have to, like, you know, induce it somehow. You know, talk about like Michael Jackson inducing, you know, a deep sleep because he was so hyper aroused all the time.
So what is the lesson from this? Do we say, you know, parents
talk to your kids and have your kids talk to you?
And what do you think we should raise our kids in a quiet, you know, rural environment with
stress is important, and also to touch your children and also let them touch you.
Yes,
this is really important. You know, it's like to be reciprocal in your touch and in your receiving of your child. And I will, you know, I think I've said this before, but parents, you only need to be receptive, especially in those first 18 months, only like 20% of the time. You don't have to overwhelm them. It's not much that's needed in that sort of direct interaction with a child that really helps establish that good bond, that good attachment. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't have to be 100%, which I think a lot of parents...
And the face-to-face interaction, face-to-face. Holding eye contact with your developing child is really important.
Responding to their needs.
Like I said, I was a teacher, and I really... could appreciate so quickly the children that were urged on by their parents to speak up and talk and speak in full sentences and to come forward with who they are. I think that what you can do and what you recommend is to draw your children out, especially in those developing years, as much as you can.
Yeah, and reciprocal touch. knowing and not taking it personally. Say if you go to touch your child and the touch isn't received, I think a lot of parents get really upset if they're not sure how to touch their child, and maybe they weren't touched appropriately and they don't know how to get in there and hold their child. Mm. I say, take a deep breath. It's about sort of finding out, who is this being? How do they want to be touched? It might not be the same way that, you know, I as a parent want to be touched.
Well, when you talk
sort
about
of notice how they receive you,
the importance of say touch when raising children, it makes me think of the RK selection theory, which is this theory of how different reproductive strategies among different animals.
Mm-hmm.
So as humans and most mammals, we're K selection. Whereas sea creatures who lay a lot of eggs, mm. or rabbits or mice who have lots of offspring, that's an R selection.
Mm.
R selection animals, what they do is they have a whole bunch of offspring, and they figure, you know, many of them won't survive, but they don't, you know, they will have enough so that some will,
right?
And they don't provide, they provide almost no care and no upbringing. Mm-hmm. Right. Think of the sea turtle that lays its eggs on the top of the beach.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then mm-hmm. all the little hatchlings have to go down this whole beach.
Yeah.
Navigate all these seagulls that are trying to get them. And then they make it into the water. And many of them will be eaten by fish and other predators.
Yeah.
But eventually, of these hundreds of sea turtles, you know, maybe a few dozen will survive.
Mm-hmm.
That's our selection. K selection, we are having much fewer offspring, but we're giving them much more care.
Yeah.
And since we're a K selecting mm-hmm. kind of animal, it's important that we not only care for our offspring, but as you say, Nasima, that we give them physical affection, right? Mm-hmm. That we maintain that physical contact, that affection. It's really important just biologically and mentally.
It's almost more important than food.
And maybe that's why the prefrontal cortex developed so much in the first place, from K-developed mammals who had many, many opportunities to nurture their offspring, as opposed to the R-type mammals.
Right.
So
yeah, yeah. It seems like the selection actually happens at conception. You know, there are lots of opportunities that run towards that egg, and only one of them gets it. So the selection happens.
And
even
so finally,
there.
The last thing that leads to impulse control is again just a reminder: the lack of stimulation. If you grow up in an environment that is deprived of noise and touch and interaction and emotional range, you're generally going to try and satisfy these basic human needs with the difficulty of impulse control, and just try to satisfy them any way you can.
Yeah.
So.
And in the treatment of it, it becomes about helping people feel that discomfort a little bit, becoming aware of it, and then, like we said, just hanging with it and seeing if another opportunity arises to meet that need.
Here's a question for you. Were you ever tempted to get another credit card?
Impulse control. I mean, a lot of people who are really struggling with credit card debt.
Yeah.
That's often, you know, that's often related to difficulty with impulses.
Yeah.
And it's always often.
And they the credit card companies target demographics, literally target demographics of people that are vulnerable to a 24.99% interest rate.
Yeah.
You know, they want those as opposed to the people that bargain and demand a 5.99% credit card interest rate. So, the impulse can come right through the mail. And it's a good way to gauge, how in control are you of your impulses.
Mm-hmm.
And we do get people come here with credit card debt or debt of some kind. And, we try to first make them see that moment where they jump at the opportunity and what need is being filled.
Right. And even like going on to buying gifts. Like sometimes people will overbuy and go into so much debt at this time of year because they feel like that will, make them feel better weddings, all these things that we spend all this money on. Is it really giving me the connection that I need, that I want?
Yeah.
and how that can be very impulsive. I know I have the problem of going out shopping and buying most of the stuff for myself.
and it satisfies something in you, right?
Yeah.
It makes you feel like...
It's like I'm gifting myself a little bit, and
yeah.
It's like, I know what I don't, you know, I don't know what anybody else needs, but I know what I need, you know. It's also alluring.
Rewards. How do we reward ourselves? And is our reward like an extreme, in excess of what we really, really need? I mean, rewarding is important to give yourself. But, you know, when it, just track it. I mean, look at it. What are you trying to make up for with this huge reward?
If you are you looking for acceptance to a certain group or a certain, you know, it's like, you know, I have to have the bag and the shoes and the earrings that, you know, will launch me into a certain.
You know, Ben, in all of our research, you know, the one impulse control type of activity that really struck me was the stealing. Because often people who steal had to compete as kids, you know. So it's not even that they need the thing right now, but there's a memory that I was deprived and that I'm in this competition mode just to get through my life. And that somehow what you own is mine too. I should have an access to that.
Right.
So the deeper the deprivation, the deeper the lack of nurturance, the more entitled you feel, to take somebody else's stuff. And again, it's rooted in this need to survive, and it's so, you know, we can judge it, and society does punish it, and this is why it needs to be under control. But it's a very sort of subtle form of impulse and lack of impulse control, because there's an internal message that I'm entitled to this.
You know, I'm reminded of a conversation that I once had with Armand DeMille's sister. And she told me a story that really stuck with me. She said that there was a time some years ago that it was very early in the morning. It was like 6 in the morning. There was no one out. She was in her car at a light. And the light said, no left turns. But there was no one around. And she thought to herself, you know, there's no people. There's no pedestrians. There's no other cars. There's no police.
Mm-hmm.
I can get away with this, can I?
Right.
And then she really thought about it. And she said, No, I can't get away with this.
Yeah.
Right? It's about really doing the right thing when no one's watching you.
Yeah.
And so she made a right, went up a few blocks, made a legal U-turn instead of making that illegal left turn. And that really stuck with me, this notion that giving to an impulse is essentially saying, I can get away with this.
Yeah.
I can get away with...
Sometimes.
I needed to use this back then, but maybe now I shouldn't.
Right. I can get away with whether it's, you know, sneaking a drink, or I can get away with eating this whole box of cookies.
Yeah.
I can get away with, skipping out on this responsibility right now go and do something fun. But when we get to the point where we realize that, you know, doing the right thing is about doing the right thing when no one else is around.
Yep.
I think that is a key to really understanding impulse.
And maturity, you know, it is a function of maturity.
Absolutely.
That you say, okay, I mean, I wasn't given the fairest of deals, but I am going to adapt to what society requires.
Sure.
And it shows control and choice in the moment.
And that's going to do you much better in the future. Mm-hmm. So it's a tricky thing. Impulse control is definitely a form of adaptation. And again, it's not something that we judge ourselves by, but it is something that we need to become aware of. And, awareness can lead to so many good things.
Yeah, and I think that some people feel like when you try to curtail their impulses, they feel like they have less freedom.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So
it's not the case.
It's not the case.
It is what people think.
I'd love to hear from our listeners out there what impulses you've been dealing with and you've been struggling with. Remember, you can always contact us at positivemind@wbai.org. That's positivemind@wbai.org. You can also contact Kevin directly. Give him a call here at the center, 212-757-4488, or you can email him kevin@thepositivemindcenter.com. That's kevin@thepositivemindcenter.com. Seema, thank you so much for joining
us today. Thank you for having me. It was great being here.
It's a pleasure.
Nice to have you.
And Kevin.
And you can reach Seema here, too.
Yes, you can. Yeah. And Kevin, it's, you know. It's,
Ben,
it's,
we'll see you next week.
It's not as much of a pleasure having you as Seema. I always get to see you, so.
Watch your impulses, Ben. Hold on.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for tuning in.
Have a good day, everybody.
Thank you. We'll be back here same time, same place next week on Tuesday at 1 p.m. only on 99.5 WBAI. Stay dry.